I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When was the last time you spent any quality time with the night sky? Oh, what do I mean by quality time here? Well, let me give you an example. My great-grandfather wrote a very brief autobiography, and here's an excerpt about some quality time he experienced at night when things were supposed to be very dark, but something went quite wrong. He writes this. About November 13, 1833, my brother and I were returning from a corn shucking about 11 o'clock at night when I noticed a number of stars falling from the heavens in the southeast direction. We watched them for a few minutes, and they increased very fast. We were greatly excited over the strange sight, but we went on home. The stars continued to fall, and we went to bed without informing Father of the peculiar occurrence, with the intention of getting up after taking a short sleep. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, I arose and went out, and the stars or meteors were still falling, so I called Father and the rest of the family, and they were greatly surprised at the strange spectacle. Many of the neighbors saw it, and they were greatly frightened, saying it was the end of the world. The spectacle continued until daylight. Well, apparently what he witnessed was a display of historic proportion. It was the annual Leonid meteor shower, and a very famous event that year. All over the country, the event was recorded in considerable detail by eyewitnesses. There have been all sorts of estimates of just how saturated with streaks of meteoric light the night sky was that evening. Some have said that more than 240,000 meteors over 9 hours were seen during the storm. Who was counting? Who could? It's no wonder that Absalom Walmsley Smith, my great-grandfather, saw fit to mention it in his life story of just 3 pages. It must have been the most astonishing natural phenomenon of his entire life. I may never be so lucky, and not just because it couldn't happen again. It could. But would I see it? Well, I'd have to be awake in the right place with a good night sky, which is to say I might need to get away from all the artificial light that pollutes our night skies. We're going to talk about the night sky now with the night sky guy, Andrew Fazekas. He's author of the National Geographic Backyard Guide to the Night Sky and writes the popular online column Starstruck for National Geographic. He's also author of the book Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe. He's a syndicated correspondent for TV and radio, and it's a pleasure to have him on the line with us. Andrew Fazekas, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Great to be here.
Andrew, I want to kind of move from the general to the particular. So let's start first with the general problem of seeing anything at night nowadays, nowadays. And then I want to move a little bit more towards the specific matter of what we might see this weekend in the sky. So how difficult is it maybe today compared to when my great-grandfather was out to see the stars?
I think, well, you know, you just have to look at how humans, you know, go about their daily lives and how things have changed over, you know, the past 2 centuries. It's incredible. Of course, we're more cosmopolitan than ever before. The industrial age happened, and we lit up our cities and towns. And what has happened because of these the technological revolution, industrial technological revolution, has led to a disconnect with the night sky. You know, as a astronomy educator, there's been so many times where, you know, I talk to kids about the Milky Way, and they think I'm talking about a chocolate bar or something and not the night sky. And it's like, you know, they know about things. People are connected with space exploration and astronomy in different ways, of course, with their devices, YouTube, the internet connects us with NASA missions, and we see that on our timelines, on Facebook and all of that, beautiful pictures. But for us to actually experience the night sky, maybe relegated to a few moments when we may be going out on a camping trip, you know, some distant exotic location in another part of the world, and we're experiencing a sky like we've never seen. We're you know, in awe and wonder of what is that up in the sky? And it's like myriads of stars. And where are they? Well, they're there. They're always there. But their artificial light pollution has blocked us. Our way of living, of looking down at our devices and texting and, you know, we're not looking up anymore. But it's there. And even if you're living in light-polluted regions, people are amazed to find out that you can do stargazing and explore the night sky. Even if you are living in typical suburbia, you don't need to go to the country cottage to begin that journey of the night sky. But it's there.
Well, how can we maximize the experience given the constraints of urban light? What do you recommend that we actually do if we're in our backyards?
Definitely, it's a place to begin. You don't need to make a trek. There's no need to delay the experience of learning the night sky. Turn off the light porch, porch lights. Find a spot where that you can not have direct light shining in your face. That's number one, very important, because any kind of light around you will diminish what you can see in the night sky. Your eyes will adapt to darkness. We all know that at night when we get out of bed, if we have to go visit the bathroom in the morning, everything you suddenly see a lot more than when you just turned off your lights when you went to bed and everything is pitch black. Your eyes will adapt to dark. It takes about 10, 15 minutes for that to happen, and wonders occur then. If you allow that dark adaptation of light, you will begin to see so many stars. Even in suburban, you will see at least dozens of stars. And guess what? Those dozens of stars are the brightest ones that belong to constellations. The patterns of stars that make up these figures, these mythological figures that are guideposts to the night sky and helps you learn navigating it. So just by doing that, spending, you know, a half hour in your backyard will do wonders in terms of learning night sky. And of course, having a good sky chart. Today we have, using that technology, we can get apps for our smartphones and tablets that will help us guide us with the GPS devices to learning those stellar patterns, finding planets, finding star clusters, where to point your telescope. We can even have robotic telescopes. All of this, there are technologies that can aid you in learning how to navigate the night sky.
Now, there's something you just said that really fascinates me, because you said that the brightest stars that make up the constellations are the ones we're most likely to see given the city lights. I wonder if those constellations are maybe even a little bit easier to pick out than if I were way out in the backcountry and the sky was just crowded with stars.
You're on the right track. Absolutely. And that is what I try to preach to people everywhere. It's like, that's why I said there's no need for you to, you know, pack up your bags and head out to the country. Yes, that's an amazing thing, and it will be an awe-inspiring event to see a dark sky. But if you're trying to learn it as a hobby, trying to understand the night sky, make it something that, you know, you can share with your family and friends and guide others, then really, the being within city limits, the light pollution is actually a good thing in terms of beginning your journey of understanding the sky. So, yeah, it kind of masks out the thousands of stars. Because I'll tell you, if you're out in a dark countryside, drive out of the city for 2 hours, 3 hours to a really, truly dark site, or maybe a park, a state or national park, you may see upwards of, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 stars. And I tell you, it's bewildering. It's a very daunting to try to figure out connecting the stars that make up constellations. It's confusing to newbies. But if you switch back and stay in your backyard in typical suburbia, that number goes down to maybe a couple of dozen, maybe a dozen. But guess what? Those mark out really the grandest the easiest stellar markers in the sky. And that's your beginning. That's your how you start. Then once you've learned that, then take a trip out to the countryside. And guess what? You'll be able to quickly find those big stellar markers, like, for instance, the Big Dipper. Or how about the Summer Triangle that's coming up now? Three brilliant stars that will be dominating the overhead skies across North America. It's something that you can see from the city, and you can see from the countryside. But you started off in the city, your journey, and then apply it to going out to a dark side. You'll immediately be able to find, recognize the Summer Triangle and the Big Dipper, and that's your guidepost to moving to other places in the sky.
So let's talk equipment for a bit here. What if I don't want to put out a whole lot of money? Am I really daunted if I don't spend a lot on this?
No, I mean, today you can go binoculars. Any standard pair of binoculars will be a great starting point platform. If you want to invest into a nice binocular, maybe you're talking about spending $150 to $300 for a good quality pair. And that may be enough for you for many years or a lifetime of excitement. With binoculars, you can unlock really neat things within constellations. Once you are familiar with a group of stars and that pattern, then you can start with star charts that you can get, you know, like in my backyard guide book, for instance, is filled with those. What we do, what's called star hopping. You start hopping from one star to the next and find little gems, that celestial gems that are hidden away, like star clusters or galaxies or gas clouds we call nebula. These things are hidden in there. You just have to find where they are. They're too faint for the naked eye to see. You use binoculars and telescopes, but you use that star hopping technique to locate them. And so that's why that's the next step in your journey with binoculars and telescopes, and you will be able to find all of these things. So a telescope, for instance, they start off a good quality one, maybe at around the $200 mark. And then, you know, the sky's the limit of what kind of telescope you want. You just want to get something that's sturdy, that doesn't give shaky views. You want to have a good mount to it and a big enough mirror or lens on it so that it collects enough of that starlight so it gives you bright, nice, contrasty views through the telescope. But, you know, your journey can take you, you know, mere maybe a month or two to graduate to the next level, or it may take you years. It depends on what your level is of comfort. And it's something that you don't need to do by yourself, by the way. You could do this with a family member, with your children, something of a parent. It's a great parent-child activity, both of you exploring at the same time the night sky, learning about it at the same levels.
Well, let's go ahead and get specific about the coming weekend. There's something going on with Mars and the Moon.
Oh, definitely. So if you're all jazzed up now, here's something for you to see. So Friday night and Saturday night, as soon as darkness falls, as soon as the sun sets, look towards where the sun sets in the west, wherever you are, and look about halfway or three quarters up the sky, and you'll notice that there's a crescent moon. That's what you're looking for. So that's easy. Crescent moon to find. But what's really cool on Friday and Saturday night, that you'll notice there's an orange star next to the moon. There's nothing else like it nearby in that part of the sky. That orange star is, in fact, planet Mars. You can see Mars for yourself. It's in the news. You hear so much NASA exploring Mars with the rover, and soon, hopefully, we'll fly the Ingenuity drone helicopter. Well, you can see the planet for yourself. It looks like a brilliant orange-colored star. And what's so cool, that color, orange, is imparted on the planet because of the iron oxide-rich sands and dust that fills the planet's surface. You see it in all the photographs that NASA takes with its rovers, that typical orange color. Well, you can see that orange color distinctly with your naked eye looking at it. And so Friday and Saturday, the moon will act as a great guidepost for you to find Mars, to locate it. And guess what? Once the moon moves away by Sunday and next week, Mars is still going to be there, and now you'll know where to find the planet Mars each night, and you could keep following it. Now, if that's not enough, next week we have a shooting star show on April 21st into 22nd. Will be the Lyrid meteor shower. It's the first meteor shower in many months for us to see, and you can expect 20 shooting stars to up to 30 shooting stars, depending on how dark your skies are. This is a show. A shooting star show is where you might want to go out to a darker location, away from the city, to see even the faintest streaks of light. And this will be something that's best seen with just the naked eye. No telescope or binoculars. Just find a comfortable place to lie down. No lights. Turn off any lights around you. Find a spot where you get a good unobstructed view of the overhead sky, and then you can count many wishes.
How long would I have to wait to see one of those really spectacular things where you see not just 20 an hour, but hundreds or thousands in an hour of meteors?
Like the famous the Leonid meteor storm of 1833 that you were referencing there. Spectacular. I mean, that's something I wish I would be able to see. That is something of maybe once in a generation that happens. Once every 30 years or so, there is what we call not a meteor shower, but a meteor storm. And that is likely to happen with, like the Leonids, which is an annual shower in November. But another one is the Perseids, which occurs in August 12th and 13th every year, like clockwork. There's about a dozen showers that occur around the calendar year, scattered across the calendar year, where you see maybe a dozen or a few dozen shooting stars. But those are once-in-a-lifetime kind of things of being able to see a true bona fide storm. And many times we cannot predict exactly when that happens. So that's why I encourage people, always take advantage of looking up at the sky for those showers, marking those on your calendar. And scientists now are at a point where we're starting to scratch at the ability of making predictions of when there may be storms coming on some of these showers. And so with the beauty of the internet, you can tap into those and kind of put it on your calendar to see.
I want to go back to that helicopter you were talking about on Mars. Are you pretty excited about that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I'm a total space nerd when it comes to that. I'm looking most forward to seeing the camera views, the aerial views that helicopter will show of the terrain underneath it as it's flying, and, of course, of the rover itself, taking a selfie of the rover from a perspective that no one's ever seen before on another world.
Well, Andrew Fazekas, let's keep our fingers crossed that maybe you and I will see one of those meteor storms before our lives are over. That would be something. You're going to be very happy if that ever happens, right?
Oh, my gosh. That's it. That's on my bucket list for sure.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you, Andrew. Thank you so much for taking time for us today.
My pleasure. And I wish all of you clear skies.
The Night Sky Guy, Andrew Fazekas, with us. He's author of the National Geographic Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. For centuries, the lonely life of an astronomer involved sleepless nights and a neck sore from leaning into a lens. This type of astronomer has actually become a vanishing breed as computers and advanced satellites take over more and more functions of astronomical observation. A tribute to the last stargazers when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It is an era in which kids do their homework remotely. From home, they're connected to their teachers and classmates using maybe something like the Zoom platform. It's easy to get a feel for the way some science today is also conducted remotely when you just think about those kids. You don't necessarily have to be on site to get the scientific job done. And it could be efficient and easy to use Zoom, but does anything get lost in this new process? Is it such a terrible thing that explorers doing their science don't need to risk life and limb, don't need to go on long journeys in pursuit of their aims? Consider the astronomer, a professional who in times past needed to travel to places where the night sky would afford a clear view. Let me just give you an example. 1769, British astronomer Charles Breen travels to Tahiti, with the famous navigator Captain James Cook. This is on Cook's first voyage around the world. And why is Breen on that ship? It's to observe and record the transit of Venus from Tahiti. This is really remarkable when you think about this. Can all of this ever be so exciting these days when you don't have to get on a ship necessarily to get your data? You can stay at home and snack on a bag of Cheetos with a Diet Coke in one hand. We're going to consider the way things used to be and hear some engaging stories of the lives and past experiences of astronomers with our next guest, Emily Levesque, who is a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington and author of The Last Stargazers, The Enduring Story of Astronomy's Vanishing Explorers. Dr. Levesque, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What about those long trips? Have you taken any of them for the sake of astronomy?
I certainly haven't taken any in the past year or so, but I have. I think a lot of us today are still experiencing an interesting mix of how astronomy is done. We sometimes travel out to telescopes that by necessity are put in some of the most remote parts of the planet to do our research. We're also really in an era where we're starting to see some creative new ways of gathering data from far away in space.
Yeah. Do you like the old way? Is there something, I don't know, are scientists ever romantic about this stuff? Do you think about it as being adventurous to be out and about?
I think people would be surprised at how often scientists are romantic about this. So for The Last Stargazers, I interviewed more than 100 of my fellow astronomers, and people talked so much about the beautiful places that we get to go for our research and just how astonishing it is to look at the night sky from a truly dark site. I think a lot of us really love the adventure and the excitement of getting to go to telescopes. And at the same time, it can be expensive to travel halfway around the world in search of our data. And it can be much more accessible if you can just operate a telescope from your laptop on your couch. So I think we all love the adventure of it, and we miss it when we don't get the chance to do it. But we also appreciate the personal advantages and the scientific advantages of being able to do it remotely.
Now, I get the idea from your book that there's been big change afoot in the means by which data is gathered. And some of this also, if you're going to be a romantic scientist, some of it has to do with, I think, the loss of hands-on, tactile, physical stuff where you're handling a glass plate or you're turning the crank that turns the telescope. Is some of that going missing these days?
Yes, we've seen a really interesting evolution in how we do something as simple as take a picture with the telescope. You mentioned glass plates, and back in the first half of the 20th century, really up through only a few decades ago, we did this by using specially treated glass plates that would be put into telescope cameras and then exposed to the night sky. The plates would darken when they were exposed to light, and that's how we would capture a picture of something like a faraway galaxy. And it sounds really primitive, but we learned incredible things about the universe using data stored on little thin sheets of glass. And nowadays, we depend more on digital imaging. There aren't any telescopes that use these glass plates anymore. And the digital observations are amazing. Just the quality level has really gone up even more. And the ability to automate telescopes and run them remotely or run them robotically has gone up. So scientifically, it's amazing, but it's a real shift from when you used to have to, you know, shiver next to a telescope all night, loading glass plates in and out of a camera. The personal experience of getting the data has really changed.
Now, I have seen you in a presentation online where you show a picture of the moon, and it's a crescent moon. It's not a full moon, and it's taken on a glass plate. And the year that image was captured was 1894. 1894, yep. And it's exquisitely clear and beautiful.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, the thing I want to point out is that I can see how the digital data is going to have greater clarity, greater precision, more detail. And yet, I think we might underplay what people were capable of capturing on those glass plates well over a century ago.
One of my favorite discoveries to remind people of that came about because of glass plates is that there were other galaxies beyond the Milky Way. And this was one of the research results that Edwin Hubble is most famous for. Now, everybody knows Hubble's name today because we have a beautiful space telescope named after him. But he discovered that the Andromeda galaxy was actually a separate galaxy by measuring the distance to that galaxy. And he did it using glass plates. So these plates really were capable of amazing feats of science. I think on the flip side, they were unbelievably fiddly and difficult to work with. I interviewed a lot of people that worked with glass plates, and you had to chemically treat them to make sure they would respond very well to very faint bits of light. You had to develop them. You had to make sure not to break them, which happened pretty frequently. And it's much easier when we have digital data to, you know, copy-paste a file and try to analyze it and maybe copy-paste it again and try something else. Just the scientific nimbleness that we get from working with digital data is really amazing. But it was incredible to see what we could do with those plates.
Many of the stories you have gathered have to do with a very human experiences of frustration and feeling thwarted and making great sacrifices, and sometimes all for naught. I love the story. I can't remember which astronomer it was, but the death threat. I want to hear the death threat story.
Oh, is this the circular chase inside a dome?
Yes, that's the one.
Yes. So this actually goes back to the story of glass plates, because these plates had to be so painstakingly prepared. And then an astronomer would actually climb into sort of the top of the telescope with the camera and with these plates and stay up there, sometimes all night, carefully exposing just one plate to point to a distant galaxy. And they would spend hours and hours just sort of hunched over the camera, making sure the telescope is pointed exactly right to get hours and hours of data to maybe get a glimpse of what a galaxy looked like. Now, there was an astronomer in the middle of doing this one night, and because he was up high in the telescope, he had a night assistant working with him. And the night assistant's job would be to do things like turn the telescope to point it at one part of the sky or another. And the night assistant would also spin the top of the big dome that the telescope was in. This is the dome people see that has a little slot in it for the telescope to peer out through. Now, the assistant wandered into the dome to just check on how the astronomer was doing. And as he stepped into the dome, his jacket caught the light switch inside the dome and flipped on the light. And now this immediately destroyed the observations, because all this blinding light came flooding into the telescope and hitting the plate and ruining hours of work that had been invested to try and get one faint picture. So the astronomer stuck up high in the telescope just howled and shouted, "What have you done? You've destroyed all this hard work I've been putting in. I'm going to get down from here and kill you." But that was much easier said than done, because he had to turn the telescope over to a little ladder mounted on the side of the wall so that he could climb down. And turning the telescope was a pretty slow process. And as he was slowly spinning through the air, the night assistant on the ground was looking up going, "He seems really mad. I might not want to let him down." And the night assistant couldn't do anything about the yelling, angry astronomer, but he could move the ladder because the ladder was attached to the building. So it turned into this hysterically slow game of chase with the ladder spinning away from the observer and the observer trying in vain to reach it to come down and shouting threats of death and dismemberment, and the night assistant just going, I'm not letting you down until you calm down. And it sounds absurd, but you think of the hours and hours of time that had been invested to get this data, and you think of the huge equipment and huge instruments involved in all of this. So it was absurd, but a window into just how much, you know, time and sort of human effort got invested in trying to get observations like that. So you can understand how frustrating it would be when something suddenly ruined it.
Well, this would be just a fun little anecdote, but I have to ask you if in your science you have not issued death threats, but had a level of frustration that was comparable because of these technical, you know, things that go wrong.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, professional astronomy is astonishingly difficult to do, and it requires so many different elements lining up. We need a enormous, incredibly delicate and complicated scientific instrument out in the middle of nowhere to be working perfectly. We need there to be no clouds. We need to time our observations very carefully to be pointed at the right star or galaxy at the right time of year, when the moon isn't too bright or when the moon hasn't risen. And when all of those elements almost align and then something goes wrong, you very much feel, you know, oh no, this chance has been lost. A thing that I think people don't realize is that telescope time is really precious, and we apply for telescope time like other scientists apply for grant funding. And if you're granted one night on a telescope, you're told, you know, all right, it's February 16th. This is your night on the telescope. And if it's cloudy or if something isn't working, your night's just lost because somebody else is right behind you in line to use the telescope the following evening. So I've lost telescope time because of clouds. I've lost telescope time because a shutter on a camera didn't work. I've talked to colleagues who lost time on telescopes because a swarm of ladybugs had landed on top of the mountain they were working on and gummed up the machinery that they were trying to use. And it was interesting to hear from so many people how these little everyday concerns of life on our planet could get in the way of solving some of the big questions that we're asking about the universe.
I have seen great colonies of ladybugs on the tops of mountains, so that's not far-fetched at all for me to imagine that they would have gone to the top of a mountain and tried to land on a telescope and caused a problem. You know, when I was a kid, I got a chance to go visit the Palomar Observatory because I lived down in San Diego in California, and we heard stories of the giant mirror, and then we heard horror stories of them trying to make mirrors and having them crack and that sort of a thing. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, but when we come back, I want to make sure that you tell your own mirror and telescope story. It's quite charming. We are visiting with Emily Levesque, and she's author of The Last Stargazers, The Enduring Story of Astronomy's Vanishing Explorers. We'll be right back. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. The Last Stargazers, a book by Dr. Emily Levesque, the subtitle, The Enduring Story of Astronomy's Vanishing Explorers. We're going to continue our conversation now. Dr. Levesque, it's sixth grade camp. I'm on Mount Palomar with other schoolmates. We're not but a mile away from the observatory on the one day, maybe day four of that whole thing. We get to go up there. And what I remember best of all was this huge disk of concrete that was sitting outside the observatory. And this big disk was supposed to hang on the end of the telescope the way the mirror would while the mirror was being manufactured, before they had installed the mirror, and they needed something that had comparable weight to kind of just sit there, you know, as a dummy. And then they I don't know how they did it, but then they slipped in the mirror, and they just left this concrete chunk sitting out there as a relic, an artifact of the manufacture of this telescope. I was so impressed by that, and I had never imagined that a mirror could be so important and so big. This is all to just ask you to tell your mirror story.
Yes. So when I write about telescopes and The Last Stargazers, I think something readers might notice is that we keep referring to them with a size. And the amazing example that you saw at Palomar was the 200-inch telescope. And 200 inches might not sound that big, but that's a mirror that's over 16 feet wide. And that particular mirror weighed 14 and a half tons. And big mirrors are one of the most important elements of a telescope because a bigger mirror lets us collect more light. It's kind of like the way the pupil in your eye will get bigger in a dark room. You're able to gather more little bits of light and you can spot really faint, faraway objects. So nowadays we have telescopes with telescopes with mirrors that are even bigger than the example that you saw at Palomar. And these are the kinds of telescopes that I use a lot for my research. So the telescope that I was sitting at one evening when something almost went terribly wrong was the Subaru telescope at Mauna Kea Observatory in Hawaii. And the telescope had a mirror that was more than 27 feet across. It was, I think at the time, the largest single piece of glass in the world. I was observing at the age of 24 as a grad student, and I was alone except for the person helping me operate the telescope. And while I was sitting there, we heard one of the computers in the room make this sort of terrible thunk sound, just sort of let off an error noise. And we looked over at it. I asked the operator what it meant, and she said, "It's okay. I think the mirror's still on the telescope. If it wasn't, we would have heard a crash." And I was petrified because I didn't know that mirrors could not be on telescopes. But it was an alarm warning us that a smaller mirror on the telescope might no longer be mechanically supported because of some of the supports seemed to have failed. And the warning was that if we weren't careful, we might have a mirror basically go tumbling off the telescope, possibly cracking or destroying that huge mirror as it fell, and effectively destroying the whole telescope. I wound up calling the engineering crew on the mountain and asking them what this could mean, and they were quick to assure me that it was probably a false alarm, and I could probably fix the problem if I just turned the telescope on and off again. We've all fixed our home internet by switching it on and off again, but I wasn't as comfortable doing this with a telescope the size of a large building, and sat there going, you know, what do I do? Because I don't want to destroy this precious mirror. This is also my only night on the telescope. And if I go away and abandon the telescope for the evening, I might have to wait a whole other year to get this data that I need for my PhD thesis. I might graduate a year later. I might move on to wherever my next job is a year later. So it sounds trivial, but it was a pretty crucial decision in how my career was about to go. And I had to, you know, gamble on whether or not this mirror really would break if I turned the telescope on and off again.
So what'd you do? You turned it, you flipped the switch on and off.
I turned it on and off again. Yes.
And it worked. I trust it worked.
Well, the full story is in the book, but I used that story to actually open The Last Stargazers because it seems like a good glimpse into just how surprisingly high stakes a night at a big telescope can be, just how wrong things can potentially go. And as, you know, the 24-year-old observer who was still learning the ropes, it seemed like something that would be familiar to some readers, that behind all the technology and all the physics, there's a human face on these stories and someone sitting there trying to think of what the best thing is to do.
Well, you may have dodged in that story maybe a technical disaster or a failure of technology. But there's potential harm to life and limb for some astronomers. You actually have a colleague who was pretty close to the devastation of Mount St. Helens, and you tell that story too.
Yes. So there was an astronomer actually here in Seattle at the University of Washington who was a graduate student and observing at Monastash Ridge Observatory, which is a small observatory in sort of south central Washington. And he was observing there on the day that Mount St. Helens erupted. And he had actually just taken, again, the first night of observations for his PhD thesis. And it had been a wonderful night. He went to bed, and then he woke up the next morning, opened the door, and instead of seeing a beautiful, clear mountaintop, and instead of getting ready for another night of observing, he just saw black smoke. He could smell this, like, sort of sour smell in the air. He tried to point a flashlight out the door, and the flashlight beam just got swallowed by the air. And he eventually learned that Mount St. Helens had erupted earlier that morning, and the plume from the volcano had blown right over the observatory and right over him. He, like any scientist, immediately thought of the telescope and made sure that it was covered and safe, because volcanic ash can really cause a lot of damage. And he then took careful notes in the observatory log. We use these logs normally to say, you know, we observed for 8 hours. The evening was very clear. There were a few clouds to the east, but we observed 12 stars to the west. And we take nice, careful notes on our observations. So he wrote this log entry that's just now become the stuff of legend on waking up on this mountain alone, being surrounded by blackness, and then realizing that the volcano had erupted and trying to take whatever safety precautions he could before leaving. So it's one of the more creative reasons anyone's ever had for having to cancel a night at a telescope.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in your community of scientists who do astronomy, there's got to be some camaraderie that develops, and there's got to be a culture all of its own. And part of what you accomplish in your book is sharing some of this culture, too. I'm wondering, is there anything like the tall tale, you know, how fishers will come back and their fish get bigger with every telling of the tale? Do you have any exaggerators among you?
Oh, absolutely. The idea for the book came from hearing some tales like this just told and retold, either on a cloudy night at a telescope, waiting for the sky to clear with your colleagues, or sitting at a conference and just hearing people talk about what it's like to observe. And I know in the astronomy community, we tell these stories as a way to kind of welcome each other to the field and share some of what's gone wrong. But there's also the stories that just take on a life of their own. And when I interviewed people for The Last Stargazers, I asked them, what's your favorite third-hand story, tenth-hand story? What's your favorite story that you absolutely cannot promise is true, but you've heard it and you love it? And I was looking for stories that got into the legendarium of the field. One of the most commonly cited ones was, oh, do you have the story about the telescope that got shot? And this is a true story and something that actually happened to a telescope in Texas. And everybody had a different version of the story dealing with when it happened, who shot the telescope, how the telescope was shot, why, what happened to it. And I eventually tracked down the true story for the book, but that was absolutely a story that had evolved and grown in the telling. I had colleagues who I would talk to who would tell me their true version of a story, and then somebody else would tell a wildly exaggerated version of that same story. So we like storytelling as much as anybody else. Stories take on lives of their own, just like they would anywhere.
Well, the crux of that particular story, there was a handgun. The handgun was fired. The bullet did hit one of those big expensive mirrors.
Yes. So an interesting thing to remember there is this happened at McDonald Observatory in Texas, and the...
Oh, I just have to stop you there. Handguns in Texas. Yeah. That's beautiful.
You know, everybody who works at the observatory is very careful to tell you that the gunman in the story was not from Texas. He was a transplant from Ohio.
Okay.
They're very careful to point that out. But an employee at the observatory became just bent on destroying one of the telescope mirrors and brandished a handgun, asked that the mirror get lowered. Fortunately, nobody was injured in this whole story, but he emptied the handgun into that big mirror. But remember what we talked about with that Palomar Observatory mirror that was 14 and a half tons of glass. Anybody who's ever used a Pyrex baking dish in their house has handled glass that's kind of like a telescope mirror's glass. So if you imagine a Pyrex dish that's a couple feet thick, shooting bullets into that glass is kind of like throwing darts at a dartboard. I think he was hoping for a dramatic shattering of the mirror, and instead the bullets just kind of went thunk and landed in the mirror and embedded. And the observatory staff were able to dig out the bullets, sort of polish over the holes, and that mirror is still being used with the bullet holes in it because the damage, shockingly, was relatively minor.
Should we even be telling stories like this? I mean, it just kind of invites, you know, troublemakers, it seems.
Well, hopefully, I think one thing people realize is that telescopes are a little harder to mess with than you might think, and there are fleets of astronomers, observatory staff, and engineers that we just could not do this work without. Every observatory has permanent staff members whose job it is to maintain and take care of and ensure the safety of these instruments, and they're maybe not who you immediately picture. When you think of an astronomer, you think of a scientist maybe in a white lab coat sort of fussing over numbers and images, but these observatory staff are critical to the work that we do.
Some of what you try to solve isn't just a mystery of what's out in space. Sometimes there's you got to troubleshoot and figure out what's going wrong right down here on terra firma. I love the story of the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia, and this has to do with trying to suss out what's interfering. There's some kind of microwave burst, and when I hear microwave burst, I just get all excited. I think about, well, there's some civilization way out millions of light years away, but that didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, so this is a funny quirk of radio telescopes, and this is an aspect of astronomy that people don't always immediately picture. When you think of a telescope, you probably think of something that you put your eye to in your backyard, something with a shiny mirror that gives you a chance to look at the moon or Saturn or something up close. And radio telescopes detect radio wavelength light. So this is light that we can't see with our eyes, but that's still being emitted by distant stars or galaxies or similar. And the catch with a radio telescope is we have a lot of stuff here on Earth that emits radio waves, as any listener is aware. So there was this telescope in Australia, the Parkes Radio Telescope, that kept picking up little bursts or blasts of radio wavelength light. And a scientist named Emily Petroff wanted to get to the bottom of these because she thought that there could be some bursts of radio light truly coming from deep space, but they needed to disentangle that from anything that could be emitting radio light just here on the ground. And what the observatory crew finally realized is that they were detecting microwave ovens, but not quite in the way you might think. They looked at the microwaves that were on site and thought, you know, those might be causing interference. We should really test those. And they carefully tested them. They microwaved, you know, a mug full of water for a minute to see if the telescope would pick it up. And it didn't. The microwaves were working nicely and the telescope wasn't picking up any signal from them. They realized what was happening when they started behaving like, you know, a hungry person microwaving popcorn before sitting down to watch a movie. They would start running the microwave and then tear open the door just before the microwave was done. And doing that released a little blast of energy that the telescope was able to pick up. Once they found that, they were able to focus on the bursts of radio light that really are from distant galaxies or distant stars. We actually still don't quite know what causes these phenomena, but we now know that microwaves can be filtered out as a possible source. So we've eliminated somebody's lunch as a possible scientific source.
Well, so much of your book celebrates people and people in your profession. And I'm just wondering if you could share a word or two about some of the stereotypes that have gone around for years and years about what astronomers are like. And you try to debunk some of that. You're kind of normal people?
I wouldn't quite go so far as to say normal, but we're as quirky as anybody in any field. And I think anybody who enjoys their job and anybody who recognizes the, you know, special language and inside jokes and habits that come with a particular job will recognize themselves in this book. And I wanted to write this book to emphasize that science is done by people and to try and put this human face on a field that it can sometimes seem pretty remote or pretty esoteric. And it's easy to think of astronomers as these, you know, experts far removed from the concerns of the planet. And in reality, nothing could be further from the truth. We're all traveling to these telescopes, struggling with everything from ladybugs to microwaves as we try to answer the questions that we're asking. And the unifying trait that I kept finding among my fellow astronomers was just how much people loved the job and how enthusiastic people were about science and about asking questions. A stereotype that always bugs me about scientists is that because we learn the math and the physics and the engineering behind something, we lose sight of the beauty of it. And I think the exact opposite is the truth. I think we gain a deeper appreciation for how beautiful the night sky is and how beautiful physics can be by knowing how it works and knowing what we're seeing. One of my favorite stories in the whole book deals with the first time I ever got the chance to see the aurora. I was seeing the southern lights down near Antarctica, and I know scientifically where the southern lights come from. And I was able to think of that as I was watching them, and it didn't diminish their beauty in the slightest. I was extra excited to see something that I'd learned about and heard about for so many years just outside the window. So that full story is in the book, but I was with a group of people who were all similarly just elated to see them. And being scientists and knowing the physics of the aurora did nothing to change how amazing we thought they looked.
In our last 60 seconds, does this enthusiasm, which is so apparent in your voice in our conversation today, it just, you exude a kind of a passion for this that's clear. Is this something you earned or learned or when did it first start?
I write about how I got interested in astronomy, and it started when I was really little, about two. And I think that enthusiasm is something that a lot of scientists share and that we are eager to pass on to others. I think enthusiasm for any topic is infectious. And I think when it comes to something like scientific inquiry and asking questions and learning more about our universe, being able to pass on that enthusiasm to others, it is my favorite part of what I do.
Dr. Emily Levesque, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us today on Constant Wonder.
Thanks for having me.
I suppose that if you know just when and where to look for one, anybody could see a meteor shower. But how many of us ever get to witness a meat shower? We're going to finish off the hour here with a highlight from a conversation with Colin Dickey, a cultural historian and author of The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained.
March 1876, a woman and her grandson are out in Olympia Springs, Kentucky, this kind of small town near the border of West Virginia, and meat falls from the sky. Chunks of meat, a couple inches in diameter, some of them smaller, in an area about 100 square feet, I think. And it's a really interesting sort of moment in American history, I think, because you know, a lot of the stuff I talk about in the book, you can say pretty conclusively that it was a hoax, or maybe, you know, it was a sort of misunderstanding or hallucination or something like that. The thing about the meat shower is like it or not, it happened. You know, we have enough definitive evidence that this was a real event. You know, the people from Olympia Springs came out, they saw this meat, they watched, you know, some of the farm animals attempt to eat it. I guess the pigs and the cats were okay. The dog didn't like it, threw it up, you know, and then a couple of very brave souls actually tried to taste it to see if they could ID it. Neither man was able to stomach it, and both of them spit it out. But, you know, so we had this event, and, you know, for a couple of months, or, you know, maybe even years, and, you know, scientists tried to explain what it was. You know, they kind of battered around theories. Maybe it was frog spawn. Maybe it was like spontaneous fungus growth. You know, one guy got a sample of it, and under a microscope, he determined that, you know, his best guess was it was either horse meat or human infant, which is a pretty disturbing but apparently under a microscope, those two look remarkably similar, I guess. So, you know, and in the end, you know, we have a working theory of what happened, which involves vultures. The kind of best guess is that sometimes apparently vultures, when they are trying to gain altitude, will lighten their load by disgorging the contents of their stomach. So the best possible guess is somehow there was a flight of vultures, you know, overhead, who all simultaneously decided to vomit their lunch so they could sort of, you know, gain altitude. And that seems to be as far as anybody's willing to take it. But, you know, the issue with that, I think, is that, you know, there were no vultures reported. You know, it was a cloudless day. It was a sort of clear sky, and that many birds vomiting that much meat, you know, you would think would have been noticed by somebody, and none of the eyewitnesses mentioned it. So, you know, I use that story in the book, other than the fact that it's just marvelous and weird and gross.
Yes, it is.
But, you know, to kind of point to the fact that, you know, there are still going to be things out there in the historical record that we just don't have good answers for. And I think that fundamentally, I think that's okay. You know, again, I mean, we talked about this earlier. I mean, you know, scientists don't, you know, argue that they understand everything in the world. They're still learning new things all the time. And that's part of what, you know, good science is. So it's, you know, sometimes the Kentucky meat shower gets used to, you know, in this kind of anti-science bent of, you know, well, you know, here's something that's, you know, clearly outside the bounds of science, and it proves that scientists don't know everybody or know everything. And I think that scientists would respond, yes, we don't know everything. And that's great, you know? And so I like the story of the Kentucky meat shower, because it suggests that there is still so much weirdness and wonder in this world that you can latch onto without necessarily having to recourse to, you know, kind of antisocial, paranoid conspiracy theories.
Colin Dickey is a cultural historian. He's author of The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Dickey, by the way, has also written about some notable grave robberies, including the graves of Beethoven and Haydn. On Monday, we're going to be talking with a British architect about his project with his friends to raise a barn the old-fashioned way in the countryside of England. Hope you can join with us then. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.